Well, the first case for argument this morning is Satkar Hospitality v. Fox Television. Ms. De Silva?
Thank you, and may it please the Court. There are three issues presented today, the first being whether the Court has jurisdiction in this matter. The second, whether the Illinois Citizens Participation Act prevents the appellants from suing Fox News and the Illinois Review blog for defamation, and whether the Illinois Citizens Participation Act, what I will refer to as the ILCPA, violates the right to petition. There is no real jurisdictional issue in this case. Judge Kennelly in the district court allowed the plaintiffs extra time to file their notice of appeal because they relied on his statements in open court, which created what Judge Kennelly deemed was an understandable confusion as to whether his ruling on what was essentially Fox's third motion to dismiss based on the ILCPA was a final and appealable order.
Did they really rely? The authorization to appeal was explicit in the original order. So how is it that the reliance on what was said later was a matter of fact when it was as plain as day that the appeal was immediately authorized?
Your Honor, it wasn't as plain as day to us. We heard Judge Kennelly in open court ask whether we were interested in getting a Rule 54B ruling.
That was later, right? He had already given it to you explicitly in writing.
Your Honor, we misunderstood, and had we believed in good faith that we did have a final appealable order, we would have filed a notice to appeal. We had always intended to.
Was there something confusing about the order or the opinion or the judgment that was entered?
It was not clear to us, Your Honor, at the time, whether it was a Rule 54B order. And apparently it wasn't.
The court finds pursuant to Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 54B that there is no just reason for delay and therefore directs the clerk to enter final judgment in favor of the media defendants.
But, Your Honor, if that were the case, then why would Judge Kennelly himself ask whether the parties wanted or were requesting a Rule 54B order in open court?
I suspect Judge Kennelly has several hundred cases on his docket at any given time, and when he decides one, moves on to the next.
Perhaps, Your Honor. But the plaintiff's counsel, in good faith, did rely on Judge Kennelly's statements in open court, which Judge Kennelly himself deemed was an excusable misunderstanding. In fact, Judge Kennelly used the words misleading the court. Of course, Judge Kennelly did not mislead the court, but he was sympathetic to the confusion caused in the minds of the plaintiff's attorneys. Contrary to Fox's assertions, Judge Kennelly did not abuse his discretion in granting the plaintiffs extra time to file their notice of appeal. The second issue here presented here today is whether the ILCPA bars the plaintiffs from bringing suit against Fox News and the Illinois Review blog. The law is clear in Illinois that it does not. In the district court, Judge Kennelly granted Fox's third motion to dismiss based on the ILCPA prior to the Illinois Supreme Court's 2012 decision in Sandom versus Caker. The Supreme Court's decision in 2012, the Illinois Supreme Court's decision in 2012, rather, overturned the appellate court decision upon which Justice Kennelly's ruling was made. The Illinois Supreme Court noted that the standard articulated in the ILCPA did not track the legislature's stated public policy. The Illinois Supreme Court stated in Sandom that it did not believe in reading the legislative background of the ILCPA that the Illinois legislature intended to bar all suits against defamation. Therefore, the Sandom court held that in order to qualify for dismissal under the ILCPA, a claim must be affirmatively identified as both meritless and retaliatory. In other words, merely invoking the ILCPA does not create an automatic bar to bring suit, in this case, against the media defendants for defamation. The The Fox and Illinois Review's briefs are full of conclusory assertions that the appellant's or the plaintiff's suit is meritless. In the district court, Judge Kennelly, however, in ruling upon Fox's first motion to dismiss, did find that the implying that someone committed a crime of bribery is, in fact, defamation. The plaintiffs were defamed, the media stories about them were false, and they actually suffered damages. Fox News and the Illinois Review ran these stories in deliberate disregard for the truth, the facts, and due diligence. They falsely accused the plaintiffs of bribery, which is a state and federal crime. The sole basis for the Illinois Review story was the word of a disgruntled former employee of Illinois State Representative Paul Frelich. This employee's name was Judy McCurdy. Not surprisingly, the same media defendants, after they ran a story about the plaintiffs in this case, or the appellants, ran a story featuring Judy McCurdy stating that she had heard a loud explosion close to her home and believed it was Paul Frelich trying to get her. The truth was that an Asian family close to the anniversary of 9/11 was targeted by a hate crime. This did not prevent the media defendants from publishing the story, stating that Paul Frelich was probably trying to bomb Judy McCurdy but got the address wrong. The very same media defendants, represented in fact by the very same counsel, are being sued by Circuit Court Judge James Ryan. In that case, the media defendants took a picture of a car and a driveway and ran a story stating that Judge Ryan at 2 p.m. was in his driveway, not in court, probably in his backyard.
I'm
possibly.
Sorry, but what does this have to do with the case in front of us?
It has to do with the standards of reporting that the media defendants in this case use, which is basically a lack of no standards for due diligence or verifying
facts.
Why
don't we stick to what's actually present before us, okay?
Yes, Your Honor. Fox's position and the Illinois Review's position, as stated in their briefs, would turn the legislative intent of the Illinois Citizens Participation Act on its head. The ILCPA was intended essentially for the little guy to speak about public affairs or matters that concern them and not be sued into silence by retaliatory lawsuits brought by better-heeled corporate defendants. In this case, it's not reasonable to think that either Rupert Murdoch or Roger Ailes needs this court's protection or is the least bit intimidated by this lawsuit. If the ILCPA were not interpreted as in light of the 2012 Sandom decision.
I assume that the legal standard does not depend upon the wealth or power of the defendant.
Correct,
right?
Your Honor.
So what are the factors that you think are decisive here?
The factors that I think the legislative intent does have bearing on the interpretation of the ILCPA. Certainly the Illinois Supreme Court thought it did, and therefore reversed the Illinois Appellate Court's decision because the Illinois Supreme Court said in Sandom versus Caker that the Illinois Appellate Court's ruling would fly in the face of legislative intent, which is important because otherwise, if, for example, the ILCPA were not read in light of the 2012 Sandom decision, it would violate the right to petition because only the most well-heeled residents of Illinois would be able to sue for defamation.
Counsel, we really don't have a question of legal interpretation of the Anti-SLAPP Act before us here. The Illinois Supreme Court has now authoritatively interpreted it. So maybe you should focus on the standard that the court established and tell us how it applies here.
Yes, Your Honor. And without repeating myself, the standard is that a suit must be found to be meritless and retaliatory. To some extent, all lawsuits are retaliatory, but this suit is not meritless because the plaintiffs, if you were to look at everything they allege in the complaint and assume that it's true, were defamed. The facts alleged are taken as true, Fox's report is factually false. Thank you.
Counsel, I just want to, before you sit down, I thought you were just saying all lawsuits are retaliatory. surely that's not what the Illinois Supreme Court meant when it said a suit had to be retaliatory to be subject to the statute.
No.
I thought the idea was that the objective of the suit was not to win on the merits, but rather to intimidate, impose punishing costs, in essence make the process so much of a deterrent so as to silence the voices of the defendants.
Yes.
Is that a fair summary of it?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Mr. Mandel?
May it please the Court. I think Justice Hamilton's question identified a key distinguishing circumstance in this case, and that is that there were, on the jurisdictional issue, there were three separate orders, each of which made that specific finding. Moreover, each of those three orders were sent to two separate counsel that were representing the appellants in this case. So while we recognize that the standard for reviewing excusable neglect is an equitable one, the timeliness of a filing of a notice of appeal is mandatory and jurisdictional, and under the circumstances here, we don't think there was any basis, equitable or otherwise, to justify the neglect in this situation. Although the appellant's counsel claims that they were confused by Judge Kennelly's comments, his impromptu comments, all that they had to do is if they had read those orders, anyone would have recognized, anyone looking at this reasonably would have recognized that Judge Kennelly simply forgot that what he had done earlier in the case. So other decisions of this case, of this court, including the Prisvoits case, recognize that counsel has a duty to read the rules, and I think the same thing should apply with respect to court orders, which are sent to counsel.
It seems like everybody forgot what was done in the original order, because presumably everybody's present in court when he makes this offer to enter a Rule 54 order, and nobody spoke up and said, Judge, you've already done it.
Correct, Your Honor. I had a recollection being there that he had entered that order, but of course I was not focused on filing a notice of appeal. The discussion, the main discussion, as the transcript reflects, is the fee petition process after the entering of the judgment. What's, I think, also significant is that on September 27th, during this colloquy, afterwards, the minute order that issued didn't say anything that was inconsistent with the notion that the 54B language had been entered. It simply just set the next status hearing. So appellant's counsel had that order for the week before that hearing, and of course they had that order after the hearing. At the very least, if Judge Kennelly's comments were inconsistent or raised some sort of confusion, I think a reasonable counsel would have asked for clarification, moved for clarification, or read the orders and proceeded accordingly. It's always difficult to make this argument because you think that sometimes the shoe could be on the other foot, but I think one of the court's decisions has asked, could we say that's easily understandable and it could happen to the best of us? Under this situation, I don't think that that's reasonable to say.
Well, we have said, Mr. Mandel, in the past that the focus may not be so much on excusable neglect as it is on should we second-guess the district judge. So how do we overcome that statement by our court?
In most cases, though, I think the courts have applied more like an estoppel analysis to it. Did the court enter an order that affirmatively led to a reasonable reliance or a justifiable reliance? And I think under the situation here, given the fact that three separate orders were entered, any reliance is not justifiable. And I don't see how it's possible to reconcile their mindset with the three orders that were entered. Now, moving to the CPA, actually, Judge Cannelli, the district court, I think, got it right in his formulation of the three issues here. One, were the defendant's acts aimed at bringing about favorable governmental change and an exercise of their speech rights? Two, was the plaintiff's claim based on, related to, or in response to the defendant's acts? And three, if so, did the plaintiff fail to produce clear and convincing evidence that the defendant's acts were not genuinely aimed? And we believe that the district court correctly answered all those questions, yes.
Well, that's a great interpretation of the statute, but
well,
then
the funny
came
thing
the Illinois
happened
Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm. Yes. What happened was is that the Supreme Court of Illinois in the Sandholm case read another word into that phrase, the plaintiff's claim is based on, related to, or in response to the defendant's acts, and that word was solely based on. And what the Supreme Court said was that, wait a second, the interpretation of the statute is going too far. We believe that the defendant has a burden, too, to show that the plaintiff's claim is solely based on the conduct in question. In other words, if that claim has independent merit as a tort or a defamation claim, then we're not going to deem it to be a slap.
So let me just put the question very bluntly.
Sure.
In view of the Illinois Supreme Court's decision in Sandholm, if we have jurisdiction to reach the merits, how could we not reverse?
Because, Your Honor, I think that based upon what's in the record, the claim is a meritless retaliatory suit. And we reach that determination. The problem with Sandholm is the court says the slap statute only applies to meritless retaliatory suits, but it doesn't say how a court makes that determination. And that's why we have cited some of the pre-Sandholm cases that go into that discussion. But to answer Your Honor's question directly, this is a defamation suit. And if you look at the allegations of the complaint, as well as the broadcast of the television defendants and the article of the Illinois Review, there is absolutely no defamatory statement in there. Although the complaint alleges that the defendants accused the plaintiffs of committing bribery, there's no such language in there.
That's the clear import of these stories.
Well, I think the clear...
That's the news angle, right?
The clear import of the stories is the questionable conduct of an elected official who is offering to help taxpayers reduce their property taxes in return for campaign contributions.
Right, and that it takes two to tango in this context, right? You got to have somebody who's susceptible of corruption and somebody who's a corrupting influence.
Well, I would say that the first of all, the reporter here is asking questions and raising questions, and I think the case law in Illinois for defamation is merely asking a question.
There may be a whole lot of good defamation defenses available here, but we're here on this Anti-SLAPP Act
on the pleadings.
The fact, I believe that the standard applicable to an elected official who is going door to door is much higher than to a citizen. There's an innocent construction here. And Representative Froehlich gave that innocent construction in his response to questions. Hey, I provide service, and these people want to contribute to me. There's not necessarily a quid pro quo. So if the reports are providing both sides of the story, then of the debate, then I think that it can be innocently construed. There's an obligation, I think, to identify the language that is supposedly defamatory. There is no language identified in the complaint or in any of the briefs that suggests how exactly any of the defendants accused the plaintiff appellants here of committing an act of bribery.
That's the implication of the story, that they were giving campaign contributions and in-kind contributions in response for favorable tax treatment and for the representative to use his influence with the board.
Respect.
And that, I mean, that's the whole import of the story. There may be, again, lots of other good defamation defenses here, but that's not the focus of an anti-SLAPP Act motion, which is really on this narrow issue of whether the suit was interposed solely for the purpose of inhibiting speech rights.
I believe there are two issues. One, whether it was meritless, and two, whether it was retaliatory. In Illinois,
The import of the Sandholm decision at the state Supreme Court is that the meritlessness inquiry is a light touch on one of these motions. It's not, you know, a full-blown summary judgment kind of an inquiry. It's, you know, if it has arguable merit on the pleadings, it's not a slap.
To answer your question, Your Honor, though, in Illinois, we don't have defamation by implication if the statements can be innocently construed. And if you read the Illinois Review article and you look at the broadcast, and I would ask the court to actually look at the broadcast instead of the transcript because it always presents a different viewpoint, there is an innocent construction to what was said here. And if some viewers could draw the implication that it's accusing the plaintiffs of an act of bribery, which, by the way, Representative Froelich points out that he could not affect the resolution of the tax appeals in any event. So question whether you can have bribery. But in any event, there's also, I believe, an innocent construction, an equally innocent and plausible construction, that they were talking about a representative who was engaging in questionable activity.
But does the Illinois Supreme Court Sandholm decision contemplate resolution of those questions on a SLAPP Act motion?
I believe it does, Your Honor, because if you look at Sandholm, it relies on a Duracraft decision out of Massachusetts, and that case involves the review of pleadings and affidavits. So certainly if a court can review affidavits, and Sandholm also says that it's appropriate to review a decision under 2619A9, which involves the submission of affirmative matter. So certainly a court, in determining an anti-SLAPP motion or a motion under the CPA, can go outside of the pleadings. And I think, as I said, the challenge to a court is that most SLAPP suits masquerade as legitimate suits. No plaintiff comes into court and says, well, this is really just meritless and retaliatory. So how does the court determine that? And we've cited a number of pre-Sandholm cases, including the Hytel case, which recognizes that if a suit is lacking in merit, first of all, it talks about judging each case on a case-by-case basis, but one indicia of retaliatory nature is the fact that it totally lacks merit. And we think that that's certainly the situation here. I would also add that counsel has referred to Rupert Murdoch and things of this nature. News Corp has nothing to do with this case. This was a broadcast put together by the locally operated WFLD Fox Chicago. Fox Television Holdings, a holding company, has nothing to do with it. These are all indicia of bringing other parties who have nothing to do with this case really to chill the investigation.
Mr. Mandel, I'm going to have to ask you to conclude.
Okay. If there's no other questions, I'm through.
I'll cut you off if you had a concluding remark.
Co-counsel,
Mr. Breen has 2 minutes.
Okay. Well,
I'm not adding his 2 to yours. I'm just giving you an opportunity to make a concluding remark.
Well, I think that given the conclusory nature of the complaint here, And if you review the broadcast, I think that Judge Cannelli was correct in the fact that there's no question that this was the type of conduct covered by the statute, and the Ryan case decision stands for that. And, of course, no evidence was offered to show that this was just some sort of sham. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mandel. Mr. Breen?
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the Court. We wanted just a brief period of time just to let the Court know and point out to the Court that only one of the Illinois Review posts mentions the appellants, only one. The appellants don't challenge the truth of any of the actual assertions of that post because every word of the post is true. That can be found at our supplemental appendix, pages A70 through A72. As well, in terms of the issues raised by Judge Sykes about the determination of merit, we do, respectfully, the Illinois Supreme Court in the Right Development Group case did go into the merit of the defamation claim there, looking at the substantial truth defense. It was applied and was allowed in that case. So we've only got two Illinois Supreme Court cases. That other one, Right Development Group, was one where they did go into the merits of that claim. And here as well, just to follow up on the point made in the brief, that the claims are time-barred. And we hadn't, my co-counsel hadn't made that point yet, but this is past the one-year statute of limitations in Illinois. And in their reply brief at page 13, the appellants had attempted to rebut our point about this without any citation to case law or statute, and likely because none applies or none exists, because there is no exception to the Single Publication Act for widely published items on the Internet. And, of course, Illinois is one of the seven or so states that has that actually enshrined as a statute, not merely as a rule. My clients, Dennis Lacombe and Fran Eaton, are volunteers. This is a labor of love for them. Had they been unable to secure pro bono legal counsel, which we were glad to provide, they very well might have had to shut down their blog due to the legal fees that would have been incurred and the burden of litigation. These were the very harms that this Citizen Participation Act was meant to meet, and who knows what other citizen journalists and bloggers, whether they will be hardy enough to sustain through a litigation like this one. We hope that they will, but again, Your Honors, that's why this act is in place, and we would ask you to apply it here.
Thank you, Mr. Breen. Ms. DeSilva?
Thank you. In terms of the jurisdictional issue that we've already discussed, the correct standard would be an examination of whether Justice Cannelli abused his discretion, and I don't believe that that is the case here, nor has the appellee's brief successfully been able to argue that Judge Cannelli abused his discretion in granting extra time to file the notice of appeal. All of the cases cited by the appellees are overruled in light of this Illinois Supreme Court's decision in Sandom in 2012. I believe almost all of their cases, if not all of them, have been overruled and are not applicable. In terms of the single publication rule, that's a new area of the law, and it has not really addressed mediums like the Internet, where the publication of something is continual and it has no expiration date, unlike in a newspaper or a magazine. So it's an interesting case, but issue rather, and one that I'm sure will be fleshed out in time. And I don't have anything else.
Back on the jurisdictional question, the judge seemed to, in granting the extension of time, rely on the confusion that he thought he had himself created in this case by his comments in court after having entered the Rule 54B order. And that legal doctrine is obsolete after Bowles versus Russell, and the judge can't rely on the court's own self-created confusion as a basis to exercise discretion to extend time or having extended some sort of reliance to counsel. So why isn't that just per se an abuse of discretion, since that legal doctrine in this context is no longer available?
Your Honor, perhaps because in open court, when Judge Kennelly mentioned, does anybody want a Rule 54B ruling? Nobody, not even the appellee's law counsel or anybody said, nobody raised the issue, well, Your Honor, you've already ruled on this and we've already brought it up there, probably because of an issue of, well, fairness and a balancing of interest. Because
well, that's what the Bowles case says is no longer viable. It doesn't matter if the court misled everybody and if everybody was laboring under the same misapprehension. That's not a basis to extend the time.
I don't believe that, despite that case, there that is a reason to say that Judge Kennelly abused his discretion and should be second-guessed.
Okay. Thank you. Our thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will proceed to the...